Welcome, everyone, to this very special edition podcast series on the 2020 Bitcoin Halving, brought to you by our friends at Bitstamp, the original global cryptocurrency exchange. Since 2011, Bitstamp's been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors everywhere, trusted by over 4 million customers, including top financial institutions. Check them out because they've got some serious professional-grade trading technology, including a matching engine from NASDAQ, some of the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface with live charting and deep analytical tools available on web and mobile. Join 4 million traders and download the Bitstamp app from the App Store or Google Play, or visit bitstamp.net/pro to get started. That's bitstamp.net/pro. And for Bitstamp users, we've got a special. Messari is now offering 25% off Messari Pro, our professional-grade crypto analytics toolkit with best-in-class research and advanced tools to help you identify your next investments. Head over to messari.io and use the offer code Bitstamp to get ahead of the crypto curve. That's messari.io, offer code Bitstamp. With that, let's dive right in. This episode's going to be a good one. All right, everyone. Welcome back to this final special episode. It's part of a series on Bitcoin halving. My guest today is none other than Tor Demeester. He's a Bitcoin analyst and investor, has been around the game for probably longer than anyone else on the research side. I actually heard Tor for the first time in Las Vegas in December of 2013. It was my first Bitcoin conference, and I walked in during his presentation. So I can honestly say that Tor is the very first person that I heard present on Bitcoin way back in the day. He has lived through now three halvings since we just had ours. We're filming this on Friday, May 15th. And of course, the most recent halving was May 11th. We're going to talk all about the halving, some of the things that Tor is looking out for in terms of trends, what he thinks about crypto more generally. He's been outspoken on some projects for sure. He's still most bullish on Bitcoin. And generally, I want to get his take on how the industry and its evolution might foreshadow the next phases of development and adoption for Bitcoin and maybe crypto more broadly. But first, Tor, why don't we just hear directly from you about your kind of path into Bitcoin and what made it so sticky for you to get involved as early as you did, and then to continue to research and write about it and be as thoughtful about its evolution as you have been.
I think the short of it is that I was kind of more on an academic path, and I was studying the theory of business cycle. I wrote a paper about it back in the day as well, and also looking at history of finance. And I just got more and more scared about inflation and systemic risk. And so I started leaning more and more towards like, well, what do I do to protect myself? I need to have some hard money, or like learn about that and how that works. And so I did my own investment newsletter, 2011 to 2013. That was in Dutch. So it was like a subscription newsletter. And then later, eventually I just went full time into Bitcoin. I made some VC investments and I hit the speaker circuit at some point and haven't looked back since.
And so what year was this that you started writing about it? It's 2011, 2012?
Yeah, but first started learning about Bitcoin, I think like April 2011. And then I felt this responsibility because I was just about to launch my financial newsletter to, do a good job at reporting on it and not like sell snake oil. So it was kind of a lucky circumstance that I had the time to really research it. And yeah, I like wrote about it first half of 2011, but it was like, it was coming down from the big bubble. At the time there was a rally to $30, which was crazy because it had barely broken $1 like months before. So I kind of discovered Bitcoin on the downslope of that bubble. Early 2012 is when I started recommending it to my subscribers.
And what about Bitcoin at the time made it recommendation worthy? Because there were no services to really procure this easily. You basically had to buy it or procure it through either Mt. Gox or maybe BitInstant. But there was a period of time there, maybe right around when it sounds like you recommended this, where for a Western audience, it was pretty inaccessible.
You like Bitstamp only came online maybe like summer 2011. So yeah, it was like, I really like racked my brain around how do I recommend people store this stuff? Like I couldn't recommend any of the exchanges. Mm-hmm. I remember writing this manual even of like, I recorded a tutorial video on, you know, you go to paperwallet.com and then you go offline and then you run the program in your browser and then it'll generate it was a clear text private key. And then they had to print it off and then finally send, you know, coins to that. But then it was just so hokey in hindsight, mm-hmm. but it was kind of the easiest way to do it back then. But so how, going back to your question, I forget now, could you remind me?
How logistically were people able to acquire it? Right. It was one thing to custody and create the private key, but how, you know, buy Bitcoin, first of all, why? And second of all, how?
Yeah, the why to me was like the first skepticism that I had was exactly about the scarcity. And then once I was convinced that it was actually scarce, that became the biggest selling point. It's like, oh, so this is digital gold. And then it's like a no-brainer. Like if it really is digital gold, and like in 2010, Satoshi on the forums, he actually described Bitcoin as like, you know, imagine a gray metal that has like no application whatsoever, except you can send it over the internet. You can send it digitally on a wire. And like, what kind of price would that metal have? And like, that's literally, he's describing digital gold. So that became, you know, how I would kind of quote unquote sell it to my audience and myself. It's like, okay, well, eventually we're going to have inflation. Eventually we'll have serious problems in the economy. And so what you want is you want to have a liquid asset that has low third-party risk and that is not very correlated with anything else. And so that's what Bitcoin has become. So that's why I wasn't worried about, oh, I can't buy coffee with Bitcoin you could barely buy anything at the time. And even today, it's pretty contested, you know, as a payment rails, it's not very attractive still.
How much of the first halving narrative was baked into that thesis? Because if you're recommending this in early 2012, the first programmatic halving is coming up later in the year. Did you think at all about the halving as an event back then, or was it just part of the kind of programmatic, or algorithmic central banking function of Bitcoin that made it interesting? Yeah. Because I can imagine at that time, you know, pre-first halving, that's almost, it's an unknown, right? It's almost like a Y2K bug. And you think it could be a positive catalyst, but you're actually not certain that it's going to go off without a hitch.
Yeah. To me, the first appeal was just the 21 million cap. Like that was just, wow. Like that's just amazing. And then like, yeah, gradually like learning, like there's this thing called the halving and it's coming up. And there were, I'd say like that's been changing over time, is that there was quite a lot of fear that maybe something might go wrong and like, you know, who knows? And we might have to fix a bug or, you know, it is like you say, it was kind of like a Y2K moment where, oh my God, what if the computers go from 1999 to 2000, like something good, you know, and nothing happened. So it was the same. And then I felt like again, the halving after that, there was again, like some fear mongering. It was, I think the second halving was, the fear was not so much that Bitcoin would have a problem per se as the protocol, but it was about the mining death spiral. Like, oh my God, like miners, they're going to lose half their income. And that was when we had just come off. I don't know. That was after the kind of professionalization of the mining sector. So that would be the first real test. Interesting
time. I guess you can almost categorize three different sets of fears, right? First halving, it was primarily about this, you know, Y2K element. It's an unknown. It's a known unknown, but it's a box that has to be checked in terms of Bitcoin's maturity as a protocol. The second, you could say, it was all about the mining death spiral. And maybe the third, most recently, it's about how sustainable or how secure Bitcoin, the network, is as the percentage of seniorage falls below 2% and then ultimately falls below 1%. And there needs to be some type of fee market that develops around it. The mining death spiral in the second halving, this is 2016, was largely overdone. We saw a brief dip in correction, and then hash rate, you know, inexorably marched forward as it has basically since inception. We're probably seeing a little bit of that again today. But I'm curious, you know, how you think about this particular halving and whether it does present any unique new security threats that need to be de-risked, much like the first two cycles, you know, de-risked both the unknown, you know, protocol level element and then the mining element.
Yeah, I mean, one other fear that was like came with the second halving in 2016, they kind of go hand in hand. With the mining death spiral fear was this kind of power concentration, like, oh my God, like one company gets access to almost all the mining. And, you know, to some extent that became true. Like Bitmain really, you know, of course there were several mining pools, but Bitmain was providing all the chips to everyone. So they had this unprecedented power in the market. Mm-hmm. And that of course makes people fearful about a 51% attack and things like that. For today, I don't see any of those concerns. Like the inflation rate was already low. I think we went from 6% to 3% now, or something like that, 2.5% maybe.
Four to two. It's even lower. I mean, the big milestone now is it's below the Fed's target inflation rate.
Uh huh. And below the actual mining inflation, the gold mining inflation rate.
Not quite, almost. We're very close, but gold is a black box. Bitcoin is a little bit more predictable.
Right. I'm sure your data is more up to date than mine. In terms of concerns, I mean, the death spiral is not going to happen. I mean, it's self-correcting when all of a sudden a lot of miners plug out their machines, which they have done, the hash rate goes down, and then 2 weeks later it gets adjusted automatically. And then, you know, it's kind of, and then all of a sudden there's a new profit incentive for miners to go in again, because then they do get some more reward. So I just don't see anything other than that it's validating that Bitcoin is just like a perfect little clock, and it just keeps ticking, and we can rely on it. And it's such a contrast with this craziness in the central banking world, where there's just like all bets are off. Who knows what's next? Mm-hmm. I don't really have a lot in terms of like, maybe the discussion about is it priced in or not, like my market efficiencies. Some people are saying that the derivatives market in Bitcoin is not very well developed yet. And so that would explain why, you know, there just wasn't a lot of opportunity for futures traders to signal like, look, this is a thing and it's going to have an impact. And so maybe we'll just have the real effect of the actual scarcity driving prices up in Bitcoin, mm-hmm. rather than like, you know, the news that does the trick for everyone.
What are the drivers now? You kind of teased this a little bit when you said, hey, it never really bothered me that you can't buy a cup of coffee with Bitcoin. I almost felt like that was an important milestone in Bitcoin's evolution, right? It's almost like the price of Bitcoin reflected the phase of adoption, which sounds obvious in hindsight, but what I mean by that is the number of Bitcoins available, the size of the total market cap was balanced in such a way that at the point in time where you needed Bitcoin to be used for experimental transactions, cups of coffee, right? Sending airdrops to someone overseas, paying for a conference ticket. It was in the double digits or the single digits or the low triple digits, which was accessible enough for most people to buy their first Bitcoin. Fast forward, you know, through the next cycle, it's hardened. There's a broad enough community. And yes, it's much more expensive for a single Bitcoin. And now there's a meme, oh, you can buy fractions of Bitcoin. Stack Sats is like the new retail focus to onboard. But at the same time, it is now expensive enough at a whole Bitcoin level where it's starting to look more like a value play for institutional investors and, you know, potentially central banks or big asset managers, because it's got this like Berkshire Hathaway effect where the price at 10,000 almost makes it look more like digital gold than the price at 100 when it was more valuable for kind of experimental trade and, you know, yes, Silk Road and gambling apps and the like. That's all narrative, but you know, I'm curious, A, what you think about that breakdown of the narrative cycles of Bitcoin. And then maybe more importantly, you know, what about your investment thesis has changed over the course of the last, you know, 8 years now?
Yeah. So in terms of the phases, the way I've looked at Bitcoin is that, you know, from 2009 to 2013, that was what I call the discovery phase, which was mm-hmm. just like you were saying, experimentation and using Bitcoin for all kinds of silly things and gambling. And it's great because it allows you to discover what this thing does. It's like, it's all a big test net in a way. And then I would say from 2013, once we had the ASIC mining chips and the hardware wallets, we kind of went into this infrastructure phase where it was really like some more capital became available to really invest in building the foundation for eventually the internet of money or that kind of thing. And so then I feel like we're still in the infrastructure phase, like 7 years later, it's still that, even like the announcement of, you know, JP Morgan now becoming the bank for Coinbase and Gemini, to me, that fits in there. It's all about building the rails, and it's both legal rails. It's the financial, like bridges between the financial industry and Bitcoin, and then a lot of technological rails with this the protocol stack of Bitcoin, where it's very clear by now with all this experimentation that you can't just scale a blockchain by boosting the block size. Like, that is going to be very cumbersome for people then to run their own nodes, and that's what then undermines the decentralization. So you don't want that. You want to be able to run a blockchain on your phone, like literally a full node, ideally, I would say. So then the answer is really that in order to scale, you have to have several layers to your protocol stack, just like with the internet that became a stack of protocols, not just TCP/IP, but also, you know, the other ones on top. And so in Bitcoin, that's, you know, the Lightning Network. I would count Liquid also as part of the protocol stack. And in some way, you could even argue that the Bitcoin exchanges have become like a second layer, because you'll be able to send, in a way, synthesized Bitcoins from one exchange to the other. You can send dollars to an exchange and own a claim on Bitcoin and never really cash it out. So there, in a way, that's kind of like a, because you're not going to pay transaction fees on your purchase. So to me, that is kind of what this story is about, like kind of slowly growing into a mature protocol stack, so that I would say my guess was between 2020 and 2022 is the deployment phase where we really go mainstream and people can start using it for many different purposes. I agree with you that right now it's institutions that are interested, and it's kind of like a land grab phase where, you know, this is going to get big, and you know, this is not correlated with the traditional financial system that's in all kinds of trouble, and you know, it's really scarce. So let's just kind of, you know, stake our claim and then see what's going to be built on top of it later. So to me, the price right now is driven mostly by institutions. I think retail is still not paying attention. I think they'll probably only come back once we're close to $20,000 or even beyond $20,000 Bitcoin. They've just been shaken out. Like, there's lots of despondency. Whoever stayed invested probably got burned between 2018 and now. And so they're kind of like laughed at the family dinner table now. And I think that's going to keep people away for a while still. But meanwhile, it's billionaires, it's family offices, it's large institutions that are kind of taking and I think Paul Tudor Jones signaled very well, like, his position is like 2%. It's perfect. It's like a, you know, either a call option or an insurance policy that he's taken out. Like, oh, what if something goes wrong with the rest, and Bitcoin is going to pay out? So yeah, those,
you know, are... There's a couple of interesting things about the halvings. So Dan Matuszewski, who's the former head at Circle Trade, maybe had the best line of the series so far. where he said, you know, yeah, it's just been a rocket ship straight up, right? It doesn't matter what time period you're looking at, you know, everything looks like it's positively correlated because, you know, Bitcoin has just done historically well on just an unprecedented scale in terms of investor returns. But the thing that I think clouds the narrative around, you know, the halving and whether it has really any impact on price and performance is a sense that there's always been a key macro driver outside of the halving in these different cycles. You know, the first one, I would argue, and this is where I got my first exposure to Bitcoin, at least about learning about it, was around the sovereign debt crises and the Eurozone crisis in 2011 and the S&P downgraded U.S. debt. And you know, just generally in that phase, there was enough, you know, true believers and hobbyists that they brute forced the infrastructure into existence that made it accessible to the kind of early investors. The second wave, you know, arguably it was around the ICO craze, right? It was actually less about Bitcoin. Yes, there was the resolution of the kind of scaling saga and SegWit 2x and the New York agreement, blah, blah, blah. But really, you know, the beginning of that super cycle was more about Ethereum and all of the, you know, the fast money that was flowing into the system around ICOs. It really wasn't until, and then, you know, kind of going into the cycle, we've got the coronavirus. So, you have people thinking about all hard money and all, store of value investments as safe plays right now, right? If you're talking about property, you're talking about gold, you're talking about, you know, other physical goods, and Bitcoin for the first time seems to be, you know, kind of lumped into that. So having or no, I would think that this next cycle is going to be more about response to the coronavirus and whether Bitcoin is a part of the solution for states, for institutions, for individuals. How have you thought about this, or have you tried to quantify this in your research?
Yeah, to me, I mean, in a way, I think the stock to flow model kind of plays into the halving a lot, where it seems like the fair value of Bitcoin all of a sudden jumps after the supply gets cut down. And then people who are critical of that model say, like, well, you know, my motivation to buy was not that there's a halving. My motivation was just that there's a cap at 21 million and I just buy into the scarcity. I don't care when the cuts happen. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think the main drivers are indeed, you know, the COVID and now liquidity and debt crisis that has come with it. And so in terms of like how I look at Bitcoin, how to value it, we put out a piece in 2019 about different valuation approaches. And to me, what makes most sense is that you want to look at what the people are doing and feeling who have been holding Bitcoin for a long time. And the reason I say this is that in a way they're the buyers and sellers of last resort. Like that, of course, we don't have a central bank, but like for lack of that, well, you look at the whales because they're going to be the ones that can fundamentally drive the market, and also they have the buying power to buy the dips, and so their confidence matters a lot. And with gold, you know, imagine trying to figure out what gold whales are doing. That's very, very hard because we don't have. If only we had a ledger where we could see, even if we couldn't identify who it was, at least if old gold was being sold or not. We don't have that, but in Bitcoin, we do. It's the blockchain. And so you can look at when old coins are moving and how much are they moving, and then kind of filter out the noise, because a lot of the activity on the blockchain is maybe like a trader who just moves in and out of Bitcoin every week. Even if he has large volume, doesn't really mean much for where the mindset of the large holders are. So, you know, one measure that I like is the Bitcoin HODLer net position change. So it's basically kind of like, It's a little bit like insider trading. Like you can just with publicly traded stocks, you can see like, are the insiders buying or selling? And that's an important signal. Like, do they have confidence? And so in Bitcoin, I don't see, you know, except for the end of 2019, there was this, when we broke down from 6,000, there was a bit of a blip where like some long-term holders did sell. But other than that, we've just seen steady accumulation among whales. So that's what they're actually doing, is that they're holding. They're not dishoarding. They're not selling, at least based on what we can see on the blockchain. And then the other kind of valuation approach that I like is the net unrealized profit and loss. So that's a bit of a mouthful, but what it basically means is that you look at all the Bitcoins that are there on the ledger, and then you look when did they move the last time? And so for every Bitcoin, you're going to look like, what was their price when it last moved? What was its price when it last moved? And you put all those together, and then you can compare the current market cap, which is all the coins in circulation times the current price, with that kind of adjusted market cap, which is like literally when everybody probably bought. And so comparing those two, you can see, is the Mr. Market as a whole, is he looking at paper profits or paper losses in dollar terms? Does that make sense?
No, it 100% does. And so we include this stat on Messari, and Coinmetrics has done a bit of work here as well. You know, basically market value to realized value. Value being when these different transaction outputs move and change over. Taking the kind of timestamp price at kind of the last movement. Thanks to our sponsor, Bitstamp, for making this special halving series possible. Bitstamp's the original global crypto exchange. We're proud to be celebrating their third Bitcoin halving. Doesn't get much more OG than that. Since 2011, Bitstamp's been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors worldwide, with over 4 million customers, including top financial institutions. They've got some serious trading tech. Matching engine from NASDAQ, the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface with live charting and deep analytical tools that are available on web and mobile. So you can join the 4 million traders on Bitstamp by downloading their app, the App Store or Google Play, or go to bitstamp.net/pro to get started. And a reminder for Bitstamp users, Messari is now offering 25% off of Messari Pro, our professional analytics toolkit with best-in-class research and advanced tools to help identify your next investments using promo code Bitstamp. That's Messari.io, offer code Bitstamp to get ahead of the crypto curve. What's interesting is every single time historically, and there's only been a few instances of this, but every single time that the current market value has fallen below the realized value, basically meaning that on net, the holder base was underwater at current prices. Yep. There's been a sharp rebound. That ratio of one seems to be a bit of a magic number for predicting market bottoms. And it makes at least a little bit of intuitive sense, because psychologically speaking, most investors hate selling their losers, right? Because they're hoping that it's going to come back up and that they'll be made whole. So it kind of does, you know, form this lower bound for the true believers and the folks that are just going to help put the bottom in, because at some point it doesn't make sense for them to sell. If they're already down, 85% peak to trough, then, what's the other 15%? Let's just hold it and like ride this thing out. And then that has a ripple effect on the rest of the holder base.
It's a really strong psychological effect that, like, that's one of the main biases in all markets, is that, like you said, investors hate to sell their losers. And so in a way they hold on too long, even if they can't afford it really. And then when they're forced to sell, then you get this like puke phase, like the real capitulation. And that's what you can see in that unrealized P&L, is that, like, yeah, you see a clear puke phase in early 2015. And then again, and that's what, like you said, when the realized cap goes under the current market cap. Again, we saw that in January 2019, and actually early this year, we saw it very, very briefly that Bitcoin did go under, like that value went negative again. So all of a sudden, but of course it was so brief, and based on the stat I talked about before, like what are the whales actually doing? The whales are just sitting tight, like they didn't care. But sentiment wise, it did kind of like hurt some people that, like, oh my God, I'm like looking at negative values. So what that means to me is it's a shakeout event. Like it just shook out the weekends. And right now we're back, and like sentiment wise, we're back pretty optimistic. Like it's like people are looking at some moderate profits right now in Bitcoin, and like combined with everything that's going on, I don't see, because what you want to look for is exuberance. Like you want to, in that measure, you want to look at, are we at, is the average investor at like 2x their original investment? Like that is kind of like more a sign of exuberance. And by the way, if anyone is listening to this and they're into data, and like maybe you guys at Messari, at some point I would love to see the Bitcoin net unrealized P&L expressed in gold, because at some point it won't really matter that we're looking at like 200% profit in dollar terms, because there'll be inflation. If you have 30, 50% annual inflation, it won't be that impressive. But if you have like 2x profits in gold expressed, well, then maybe Bitcoin is a bit overvalued. Anyway, but right now value, like sentiment is very, very healthy. Like if anything, investors are still a little bit scared rather than, you know, exuberant.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, everybody's looking forward to the next puke phase, as you call it, being from, you know, 150,000 down to 30,000. When again, at 30,000, which is three times where we are right now, every major financial publication will write about the demise of Bitcoin because it just crashed 80%.
Slew of obituaries for sure.
Do you have a price outlook? I know, you know, most people that's just voodoo math, but you mentioned stock to flow and obviously you've been thoughtful about valuation approaches. You know, one, that I'm not sure if maybe you've taken a look at, we talked about Paul Tudor Jones. What is the impact of having hedge funds as an asset class allocate 50 basis points or 1 point or two whole points of their portfolios into Bitcoin, right? And what does that mean for the market move? Because it's not, it's much more than 1-to-1, right? So $1 of net inflows equals much more than, you know, $1 of added market cap, because there is a, you know, if you think about this as an order book, there are certain holders whose ask is much, much higher than it is right now, right? Like my ask is not even going to be priced into the order book. And many others are the same. So if you think about, you know, billions of dollars of institutional flows into Bitcoin in particular, that's going to have just an enormous impact on the price. But it's much, much harder to move the price than it was in 2017. A, because the markets are more efficient, you've got some derivatives infrastructure, and you know, generally speaking, you know, the retail market does not have nearly as much dry powder to move the needle as the institutional base. Where have you done that analysis, number one, and what are your general thoughts on magnitude?
Yeah, I put together this piece, which maybe that's the presentation you might have seen in 2013, with some projections of, at the time, Bitcoin was like $100. And so there were like these what if questions, like, okay, like what if, you know, Bitcoin grows to 1% of the gold, all the gold in the world, or like what if hedge fund invests 1% of their, you know, their AUM, assets under management, into Bitcoin, what could conceivably be the Bitcoin price? And of course these are like super rough estimates, but I think for, it was like if hedge funds move 1% of their assets into Bitcoin, I need to look it up, but I thought it was like $40,000 Bitcoin or something like that. Like, so mm-hmm. These are really valid analyses to look at potential sources of demand. It's happening. I don't know. I think that, the macro story is just there and it all fits. And right now, of course, there's more like directionally driven hedge funds that are looking into it. But in terms of like where that could bring us for the price, I wouldn't be surprised if this cycle, this bull market, which now we're back in a bull market. I think, you know, for sure, $3,000-$4,000 was the bottom. I don't think we'll go below 6,000 again. I mean, I think a price target of like $50,000 is not insane at all, especially given just how crazy the money printing is. I would even say like mm-hmm. between 50 and 100,000. And the question is more like, what is the dollar going to be worth once we're at $100,000 Bitcoin? So like, you know, if a bicycle costs instead of $200, $1,000, well, you have to kind of discount for that.
At a certain price of Bitcoin, the dollar equivalent becomes, you know, the price of it, Bitcoin could be infinite. So, you know, I've said that, you know, Bitcoin is either going to be worth, you know, zero, or it'll basically be worth $1 million, $1 billion, you know, $1 trillion, doesn't really matter, because At some market cap, it means that Bitcoin has gotten so big that it is more dominant than certain fiat currencies, right? And reserve currencies.
And then it becomes the denominator, yeah.
Yep. I'm curious, you know, you've been bullish for so long. You've been a constant in the industry for so long. What, if anything, keeps you up at night? Or, we've de-risked halvings, we've de-risked, centralized exchange collapses, we've de-risked, quite a bit of geopolitical risk. Not all of it, but a good chunk of it. What, does anything keep you up at night, or kind of what's next on the hit list or checklist of things to de-risk as a Bitcoin investor?
Yeah, lately I've literally been battling some insomnia, and it's, I'm not kidding. It's 'cause I'm worried not so much about the pandemic. I'm worried about, to put it briefly, I'm worried about hyperinflation and how unexpected that might be for the public at large. And then basically how people are going to respond to that, how it could change the political landscape, all kinds of draconian measures that now are hard to imagine could become very, very normal in an environment where we have super high inflation. We're already seeing it with like this COVID crisis, like things like rent control, who could have thought 1 year ago that right now, and I'm not making a case for all the landlords that they're all, you know, angels or anything, but who could have predicted that you cannot evict a tenant who is not paying their rent? You know, 1 year ago, who could imagine that, like, nationwide or even internationally speaking, that's now a reality. So price controls, rent controls, and then, of course, you know, and 1931 comes to mind where gold was confiscated. So all these scenarios where you just don't know, you know, there's chaos coming, but the nature of chaos is that you can't really predict it. So you try to, like, keep your options open and just... You know, it's, and I've been thinking about this stuff for 10 years and I still don't know, like, what is the right thing to do and what is the right answer. And I'm just trying to kind of like accept that, like, you know, I think that I've always been a little bit ahead of the curve when it comes to like seeing things coming, and I'm trying to keep my options open. I mean, but it's still like, it's like I have to process that, like, people are going to freak out. Like, they're going to freak out. And I just, in a way, I'm trying to prepare myself that is just going to happen. And I, in a way, I have to put my horizon further than that. I have to, like, already look beyond, and it's going to be a period of like 3, 4, 5 years where, you know, debt is going to be wiped out, which is good. Like, finally, we're going to get rid of this debt burden. And there's going to be a new normal after that. But like during, that's just going to be a bit crazy. And I lived in Latin America. Like, I know it's not the end of the world. Like, you can totally live through it and you can do well. But it is just strange to just
painful reset.
It's like Cassandra feeling of like, oh my God, like this is it. Like, this is where everybody's printing money and nobody's worried about it because their eyes are off the ball. They're looking at something else, which is, I think, the coronavirus crisis, and they think this is the end of the world. And so, and now it's this cascade where, okay, they're bailing out whatever XYZ companies, but then because they're overextending, all the governments are overextending, we're going to get into this crazy debt crisis. And then central banks are going to buy up all the municipal bonds you can imagine. And they're going to rescue life insurance companies. And it's just going to be off the rails. Like, we're going to have $1 trillion bailouts every other month, I think, eventually. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's what keeps me up at.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what you're talking about applies to the U.S. and Europe, obviously, and those are two of the, you know, U.S. and Euro being, you know, the two largest reserve currencies. So, you know, potentially the ones that will have the most chaos associated with them if there is something that goes haywire. You mentioned the seizure of gold in the 30s. You know, at what point, I haven't really heard of many people talking about this seriously yet, but at what point... do you think people start truly taking seriously movements from the U.S. or Eurozone or wherever they are?
What do you mean with movements?
Emigration.
And is confiscation?
Well, I mean, if you're in a country where you are worried that your wealth is going to be seized, if there is a similar order that impacts Bitcoin, you know, at some points in the not too distant future, does that put you in a position where you're ready to pack your bags and move to more stable or more crypto friendly locations? Because, you know, the one thing that's interesting about kind of where we are in the world right now, like there is no more physical land, right? So you basically need to pick your tallest midget in terms of like which country or which, you know, set of laws, which jurisdiction you want to be bound to. And it strikes me that the time, in some respects, it may have passed already, but in others, if people are going to take seriously a move or think about, you know, where is the optimal, you know, safest and most secure location, they might have to make that decision relatively soon. And I'm quite frankly, I'm surprised that we haven't seen it bubble up more in crypto circles, because that tends to be the bleeding edge of you know, folks that are thinking about how hostile actions could impact them, their families, their portfolios, and just their personal property rights.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard, but for me, I think optionality is just huge. And Nick Szabo has talked about this. And as far as I know, his family had to flee Hungary. Like, they barely made it out. So definitely there's people to learn from. And in a way, Bitcoin represents, like, it's the ultimate optionality. Like, it allows you to move your money around the world. You can even send it to a friend. Like, even like, you know, you hear on television, like, we're going to start confiscating blah, blah, blah. And like, you can pick up your phone right after and send all your Bitcoin to a friend who lives on the other side of the world. Like, that's physically possible. So I think that's important. And I think a lot of Bitcoiners kind of feel that gives them some like autonomy and in a way it's too early to know where it's going to be bad and where it's going to be good. So I think that's important. I think in a way also living in the US offers actual optionality too, because like, I think that we've seen peak power for Washington and the White House. I think that we're going to see a slow decline of the kind of hold that they can have on just by issuing orders and stuff. I think eventually we'll have states that are just going to be like, sorry, but no, I'm not going to do that. Like, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to like invade me now? Come at me, bro. I don't know. that is something that, you know, you have the ability to vote with your feet in the US, and you can just jump in your car and drive across the state line. And then you're in another environment that still has a lot of similarities with rule of law and language and market structure. And so I think that eventually it'll be hard for the federal government that has created this problem. You know, a lot of the problem is created by just this excessive debt and this monetary destruction. That it might be hard to keep their hold on everything. I mean, this is how empires dissolve. Like, you know, Rome, the Roman Empire dissolved through inflation. The USSR did. I'm not saying the US will, but I'm saying like there is a limit to the kind of how far you can go with federal government orders. And in Europe, like it's a different trade-off. Like there's even less centralized power. Like Brussels is kind of like a running joke. And I think it will become even more so. But then I think there, the challenge is a little bit more on the rule of law side, where, you know, what countries other than Switzerland have really strong rule of law that can weather even like a very severe depression or a crisis? And I don't really know. I think we'll have to wait and see. And then the other countries around the world, of course, you can go to Latin America, but like the you know, maybe I would, you know, if things got really bad, I might go to Chile or something. But still, like, they have a history of dictatorships and stuff like that. And so you don't, you know, I think it's too early to place your bets. Like, you, the only thing you want to own is some call options, some put options. Like, it's all about optionality, I think, right now. That's how I see it.
To preserve your optionality, what are your thoughts on other assets or other crypto assets? You know, you've been very outspoken and to the negative about some other crypto assets. Is there anything that would get you excited about other types of cryptos, or do you view Bitcoin in the context of a broader real world portfolio and just sticking with Bitcoin as the one digital asset that's a good portable and censorship resistant hedge to everything else going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I think Bitcoin in the cryptocurrency realm, like, I think you want to be overweight Bitcoin. Like, you have like very, very significant part of your portfolio. But it's almost like in the gold world and in the world of precious metals, you want to own mainly gold. Of course, you can have some silver too and some miners and like have that be like 30% max or something. And of course, it's all, everybody's different and who knows, like, you know. But like, for example, it matters if you have a capital gains environment or not. Like, you know, if you can easily trade out of coins, then maybe you can have a bit more exposure or something, or if you're a good trader or whatever. But I do think, generally speaking, that the altcoins, by and large, are not going to come back, especially not as strongly as they did in 2017. So the Bitcoin dominance rate is never going to go, I think, as low as it did back then. I think a few coins are going to do well. I mean, I have a few Litecoin, like, people are going to shoot me now because I just, as a play on, I've always kind of beat myself up that my investments were driven by like my analysis and like, you know, this is what I think and this, whatever, this technology doesn't really make sense. I'm not going to own it. Whereas I missed out, like I missed out on Ethereum because I wasn't thinking in terms of the market psychology, you know, where it could go. And so I feel like if we're going to have a retail phase, again, people are, and Bitcoin inevitably is going to be labeled the digital gold. And so then they're going to be like with their unit bias, they're going to be like, one Bitcoin is so expensive. What else is there? So who knows? I just have a little bit, you never know. And then another area that I'm, and I think my theory in general is that we never have the same market cycle twice. Like there's always different emphases. Like in 2013, it was not really about altcoins. The big buzz was mining. Everybody was ordering mining machines and that was the craze. And of course, Bitcoin went up as well. And then in 2017, it was altcoins. I think in the next cycle, we're going to have some other things that kind of bubble up together with Bitcoin. One area that I've been looking at is the exchange. And again, I'm going to get roasted for this, but it's IEOs, the exchange tokens.
The exchange token. Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think you get roasted for that. I mean, they're basically quasi securities because they've got burn models.
That's why. Like, I mean, that's why to me, like, you know, I put together that report on the Bitcoin Reformation back then. Like, you know, other than owning shares in the VOC, the East India Company, which was the Bitcoin of the time, what you could do is you could invest in basically local government bonds. And you had these like little local cities that sometimes needed to beef up their defenses against the Spanish army who was invading. And you could do very well. If you moderately invested in those, you could do really well. And so similarly, Bitcoin exchanges are going to be under fire. They're going to have to defend themselves. There's no sugar daddy central bank to bail them out. So that could be an area where you could, you know, strategically, occasionally, put some money to work in it. And they're always going to, they know that their main audience are Bitcoiners. So they're going to try to put together deals that are attractive, even for people that are used to the kind of returns that you see in Bitcoin. So that's kind of my best analysis for the moment. I'm not really looking at a lot of altcoins. Maybe also where things could go, like we're going to see some IPOs, I think, because like some of these early companies, they want their executives and everybody else, the shareholders, to be able to diversify because they're looking at the same reality we are. Maybe 80% of their wealth is wrapped up into a company stock. Like that's too much. So they need liquidity. And so I think we'll see there'll be some interesting opportunities for, if you time it right, to invest in some Bitcoin companies. But that's going to probably be a little while longer.
Tor, it's always fascinating to hear your thoughts on the industry. It just comes with so much historical context, both crypto, you know, specific, Bitcoin specific, and you know, much more broadly in a historical context. Where can people find you online, read some of your more recent research?
Yeah, I would say just Google my name. I think I have the still the
two Bitcoin, U's. T-U-U-R, two U's.
T-U-U-R and then four E's in my last name. The Bitcoin Reformation is still out there. If you haven't read it, I suggest you have a look. It's probably what the work I'm most proud of for the moment. And then I'm slowly working on a report that's going to focus more on inflation. Probably in the next 1 or 2 months, it'll come out.
Excellent. Well, looking forward to that one. Tor, a true OG, thank you very much for joining. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in for this final installment of the special Bitcoin Halving series that we've done in conjunction with Bitstamp. Tor, stay safe. Thanks again. And to all listeners who are listening, watching, be good. Till next time. Peace.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. New episodes of Unqualified Opinions go live weekdays at noon Eastern Time. You can follow me in the meantime on Twitter at 2BitIdiot if you want to continue the conversation or troll me. Otherwise, I'll see you next week.